Waves. I take it back. It's a live episode of Animal Airwaves Live today. Don't let that man try to trick you. I'm Dana Hill, and today is what, the 23rd of March 2018 on Friday, and it's 1 o'clock, and I'm really glad you've joined me for Animal Airwaves Live. My guest today from the University of Florida College of Veterinary Medicine is Dr. Ashley Allen, and the topic of the program today, new puppy or kitten, question mark, how to avoid common veterinary emergencies. We're going to talk about puppies and kittens today, and you can join the conversation. 352-392-8989 is the number. We'll be back with Animal Airwaves Live right after this. Hi, welcome to Animal Airwaves Live here on WUFT-FM. I'm Dana Hill, and this is our weekly hour-long call-in show devoted to the discussion of the health and welfare of animals. Thanks for tuning in here on Friday, the 23rd of March, 2018. It's a beautiful day. I'm glad you're listening this Friday. I hope you're enjoying the afternoon, and I really appreciate everyone who has already called in during our spring 2018 membership campaign. If you'd like to pledge your support, if you enjoy Animal Airwaves Live, our website is wuft.org. Go ahead and make a pledge there, and we're very grateful for that. But meanwhile, to get down to the business of this show, my guest from the University of Florida College of Veterinary Medicine, back for another visit, is Dr. Ashley Allen, and I'm really grateful to her for being here. And we're going to be talking today about puppies and kittens and how to avoid common veterinary emergencies. Of course, you bring home a new puppy or kitten and you're so excited and you want everything to go really, really well, but sometimes things can go wrong, and we're going to try to find out what to do if things do go wrong and maybe how to avoid things that might go wrong from happening. So welcome back to the show. I'm glad you're here.
Thank you.
I should tell everyone who's listening, I apologize. My voice is kind of not great. I've lost my voice in this pledge drive week, and I know that's the worst time. So if you hear me struggling, please just bear with me, and I appreciate your patience. So Dr. Allen, when we talk about puppies and kittens, am I right to say that pretty much we're all excited? We bring home these dogs and cats, and it's a fun time for the family, and we want to play with them. And normally everything just goes okay, and then they become adult dogs or adult cats, and everything is okay. But sometimes things can happen, and when problems arise, it's better to be prepared than unprepared, right? So let's talk today about things that can go wrong. What do you see most often?
So I did a little brainstorming for today, and I kind of jotted down a little list of things that I see in the emergency quite frequently. And again, most puppies and kittens are fine, and they don't need assistance from an emergency veterinarian, but some do, and some things are somewhat not 100% preventable, but we can try and be cognizant of them so that we can avoid them. So kind of number one on my list is electrocution, because they are mouthy little guys and they like to chew just like babies' teeth. Puppies and kittens, they also do the same thing and they want to chew on things. So electrocution from cords really is the primary one. And then oftentimes there may be another animal in the house prior to bringing home the puppy and kitten or kitten. And then that other animal may not be appreciative that you brought home a new baby. So being attacked by the housemate's a somewhat common issue. Head trauma in babies, not intentionally, but unintentionally happens for sure. Toy breeds are pretty susceptible to low glucose. I have a whole list we could go on, but so parvovirus this summer is the time that we worry about parvovirus the most, and a lot of other parasites that we can chat about.
Okay, well, let's just dive in here with what you mentioned first, which was electrocution. Now, I've seen dogs and cats sort of chewing on things, and I know I've had conversations with some of your colleagues before about some other kinds of animals that people might have that even when they're adults tend to chew on cords, like rabbits or something. A pet rabbit might tend to do that. What is it about puppies and kittens that makes them liable to chew on things like cords when, you know, doesn't seem very tasty to me?
No, I agree. They just get into everything. I mean, they're just like children. So we were just chatting. We both have kids, and I have a 23-month-old right now, and he likes to get into anything he can find. So puppies are very similar. I can honestly say I've only seen one kitten that had electrocution from a cord injury, so I think it's a little less likely in kittens. I don't know why, but puppies seem to be a little more naughty in that regard. And they're cool, right? They're hanging from the wall. They're dangling. They like to bat them around and play with them and then chomp on them. So,
yeah, okay. So puppies and kittens, I guess, they have teeth pretty much right away, mostly,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. They're not born with teeth, so.
Really?
Uh-huh.
I feel like, I guess, I haven't been around a puppy or a kitten in a long time. A puppy, certainly, in a long time.
Yeah.
Kitten, maybe not so recently either. So when would they start chewing on them, once they get their teeth?
Yeah. So usually we're talking about that, like, 12-week-old mark. Somewhere between, 8 and 12 weeks is – and really, like, the – puppies that chew the most are probably 12 weeks and on. So 12 weeks up to a year of life.
Oh, well, so, I mean, we'd be talking about animals that are of an adoptable age anyway.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. So by then they're getting their teeth?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that's why I had to have never noticed that, like, cats or puppies don't have teeth, because I wouldn't be around them when they're, like, first
a
brand
day
new.
Old. Yep. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So they start chewing on things. And, maybe if it's just like your cord that charges your phone, not such a big deal, except for it destroys your cord. But if it's, a regular mains cord that connects to the 120-volt, 15-amp circuit or whatever, then that could be potentially lethal.
Yeah, exactly. So what happens when you get electrocuted? So one is it causes a pretty prominent burn inside of their mouth. And so that can cause all kinds of issues, because it literally is a huge electrical burn that can occur inside, and that's really painful. So then you have this little puppy that may also be a toy breed that's susceptible to low glucose and then has a cord burn in the mouth and doesn't want to eat or drink, and they can get dehydrated very quickly and not want to eat and hypoglycemic from that. But really what happens that puts them into the emergency room with me more often than not is when you get electrocuted, your lungs can take a big hit, and you get what's called non-cardiogenic pulmonary edema. So your lungs actually fill up with fluid secondary to the electrical shock, and that can be mild. So some puppies just need, when that happens, their respiratory rate goes up very fast. They look like they're struggling to breathe. And a lot of puppies we can just kind of conservatively manage, meaning that they sit in an oxygen cage usually for 2 to 4 days while we're kind of waiting for that fluid to resolve. But we've had a handful of puppies that wasn't enough, and they've actually had to go on a ventilator and a breathing machine to breathe for them because of the fluid in their lungs. So electrical burn and the lung hit is kind of the big deal.
Okay. Now, that seems very frightening. It might occur, though, while someone is not looking.
Yeah.
So if you came home and the animal had gotten into something, what might you notice that should alarm you?
Yeah, it's a rapid respiratory rate. So, and they're pretty lethargic. If you're struggling to breathe because you don't have enough oxygen in your body, you're probably not jumping around and being your normal puppy self. So it's usually a lethargic puppy that has a very rapid respiratory rate. And oftentimes owners won't pick up on the burn inside of the mouth unless you open and you have a light source and you can kind of look around. So it's usually the respiratory rate that brings them in.
So once an animal has been, say, in an oxygen cage and is gotten its breathing kind of under control, how long might it take for the mouth to heal before the animal can eat again effectively?
Yeah, that can take it can happen quickly. The mouth heals fairly quickly, but so most of the time we don't have to do much except feed them a wet slurry of food, something very soft. I've had one puppy, though, that had a pretty bad cord burn in the mouth that we had to put a little feeding tube in just to keep the puppy fed until we could take the tube out about a week later when he could eat on his own again.
Mm, okay. Yeah. But overall, I mean, the prognosis, is it okay? Or, I mean, are these injuries often fatal?
I think overall the prognosis is pretty good. If you end up on a ventilator from electrical injury, I think the prognosis is pretty guarded. So because it's just a more severe injury, and it's a lot more to contend with.
Mm-hmm.
And this isn't something that's 100% preventable. But, I mean, there are things that you can try and do at home to prevent your puppy getting to that position.
Right. Now, child-proofing a home for, like, a human child, it's a whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes you just have to kind of watch the child and see what the child is going to do.
Yeah.
And then you'll realize, oh, I wouldn't have even thought that that would be such a big deal. I mean, you do the obvious things. You maybe cover up the unused electrical outlets, and you don't want to leave a lot of knives and stuff lying around on the coffee table. But there's some things that, you know, lamps have to be plugged in somewhere. And, you know, if you're lucky, the cord just goes behind the couch. But sometimes the cord is exposed, and you just have to, you know, keep track of what your young one is doing, be it a human or animal. I've never had an animal do that, really. And I guess I hadn't given that much thought before. But common enough that it warrants discussion.
Yeah, I mean, we probably see at least 10 plus per year here in Gainesville, and probably about the same number at our emergency clinic in Ocala.
Yeah, so, okay.
Yeah.
So let's talk next about the other animals that might be in the house. Mm-hmm. You bring home a puppy or a kitten, and let's say you already have like an adult dog or an adult cat. What kind of reaction might your adult dog or cat demonstrate to that would make you concerned for the safety of the young animal?
Yeah, I think it's probably knowing that other adults and knowing what triggers them. You know, some dogs are very motivated by food. Some dogs are very motivated by toys. Some cats really like their own space. And so kind of knowing that before you bring the puppy or kitten home, what may or may not be an issue for that particular older housemate. So I would say if you have a dog that's very food motivated, and regardless of whether or not the dog's food motivated or not, that they should be fed in separate areas. So I wouldn't put food bowls next to each other because that's a point of contention. Other things are like toys. So I would have separate puppy toys versus – and don't take the older dog's toy and give it to the puppy. So I think those things are very easy things that you can manipulate at home. I also would never leave them unattended together. I wouldn't get a new puppy and leave him out and go run to the grocery store and do anything until, you know, you've established their relationship at home. So crate training for both electrocution and for the housemate issue is something that I would recommend.
Is the problem largely with adult dogs and puppies and kittens, or might adult cats be potentially dangerous to puppies or kittens?
I think a lot of cats just kind of run. I don't know that a lot of it is malicious from a cat standpoint, but I've seen, so just some random things I've seen in my life. Like a puppy came in that had a cat claw on his eyeball. Because probably the puppy was excited and trying to play with the new cat, and they just whacked him on the face. And the claw actually lacerated the eye and actually came off inside of the cornea.
Oh, no.
And I think it's just normal animal behavior. But again, if maybe trying to prevent that puppy from jumping in the older cat's face, it doesn't have to be an older cat either. It could be any cat. And I've seen one cat, actually the one that I ended up adopting, the first home that it went to, the other cat was not okay with it and bit the kitten the first night there and ended up getting a large abscess. Cats are finicky sometimes. They like their space.
You know, I guess I'd never experienced that either. I've certainly experienced, the original cat not appreciating the presence of this new animal and displaying certain behaviors that would indicate its lack of enthusiasm for the newcomer, right? Like inappropriate urination or something like that.
Oh, yeah.
When you bring home another animal. With adult dogs in the house, though, if you have a dog that has ever displayed any kind of aggression, that is a warning sign right there.
Yeah.
And even if it's like food aggression, right? Like if an animal that's motivated by food, as you said, might see a new pet as real competition.
Right.
And now this new animal is in my territory, so to speak. And feeding them in separate areas does make a lot of sense. Of course, a pet owner would have to kind of pick another place where that's appropriate.
Right.
And it sounds like if you should be leaving these animals in separate areas while you're away, right? And I don't know how many people are able to take off a couple weeks of work when adopting a pet. So you might have to leave for part of the day.
Yeah.
So keeping the two animals separate, about how long would these two animals need before you can you can trust that they've become friends?
Oh, I don't know about that. I mean, that probably depends on the pair, you know, and some of them never become friends. And I've been in situations where people have had to get rid of the new pet just because I've treated 2, 3, 4 dog fights between the two of them, and they just never will become friends. So I think that's dependent on the two animals. Some of them are best friends from day one, and just some of them aren't. So, but crate training, I think, is a really good idea for puppies. You can feed them in the crate.
Yeah.
So
explain how that would work, crate training.
Oh, yeah. So you buy a crate that's big enough. You don't want it too large because then they'll never really become potty trained if they think that they can just pee and poop in there all the time. So you kind of buy it appropriately sized for the pet. And
this is for the newcomer?
Yeah. Okay. And some older dogs are crate trained too. So when I was in vet school and stuff, my dogs were crate trained because I lived in a house with other people. And so we didn't want to take the chances of older pets getting into it while we were in school. And so they pretty much stay in their crate during the day. Now, when you have a new puppy, you need to be able to – they have to go to the bathroom frequently. So if you have any intention on actually potty training that puppy with a crate, you need to have some type of time frame set up where they're in the crate and you can let them out frequently. So you may have to come home on lunch breaks or hire the next door neighbor's kid to come over and kind of let the puppy out frequently to go potty.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Might that territoriality, if that's a word, extend to the out of doors? That is to say, let's imagine that when you get home from work, you let your adult dog outside, mm-hmm, into your backyard.
Yeah.
If you then begin to do that with the puppy, might they come into conflict outside because one is used to just kind of like having the run of the place?
Yeah. Yeah. So I think a reasonable thing to do the first week that you have the puppy there is to just put the puppy on a leash. So I think leashes are a good idea. You can control the movement. Let the older dog do his normal thing and just leash walk the puppy in the backyard. That way they're getting used to each other, but you still maintain control over the situation more so than you would if you just let them out. And then slowly over time, start giving the puppy more freedom. And like I said, some dogs are best friends from day one, and some of this you don't ever have to worry about. But for the pair that you may worry about, then I think leashing the dog in the backyard.
Before we take a little break, mm-hmm, there are things that, like you just mentioned, that you can do to maybe keep the smaller ones safe. Are there any sort of tips or tricks for making it more likely that the new one is welcomed by the older one, right? That is to say, that is there a way that, you know, you can introduce them that would give you a leg up, so to speak, in terms of building a friendly relationship?
Yeah, I think, I mean, so I'm not an animal behaviorist, and I actually own a German Shepherd who's like fairly not well behaved. But with that said, they're not that different from kids. And so if you have something that smells like the new puppy, but you haven't brought the new puppy home yet, like throw it in the area where the big dog is so that they start getting that sense of smell before you just introduce them. If you separate them by a room, so say like put the puppy in the bathroom, let the big dog have the run of the house like they normally would, so that they smell them, they can hear them, but they're not actually with them yet, just mm-hmm, to kind of get them used to the fact that, hey, this is going to be a thing and we're going to live together.
Okay.
Yeah.
Great. This is Animal Airwaves Live. I'm Dana Hill. My guest is Dr. Ashley Allen. We're going to take a short break and we'll be back with more show right after this. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Animal Airwaves Live. So glad you've tuned in on this Friday, the 23rd of March. I'm Dana Hill, and my guest today is Dr. Ashley Allen from the UF College of Veterinary Medicine. We're talking about new puppies and kittens and how you can avoid veterinary emergencies when you bring a new animal friend home. And this program is, of course, supported by listeners just like you. And not only do we appreciate your pledges, we need them, too, to help pay for the other programming. So if you have not yet pledged during this membership campaign here in the spring 2018, hope you'll do so right now at our webpage, wuft.org. If you'd like to join this conversation here on the show today, if you have a question about a dog or a cat, our telephone number is 352-392-8989. So, Dr. Allen, you mentioned that head trauma can be another potential emergency with a new puppy or a new kitten. How does this happen? I imagine different ways, but are there incidents that you see more frequently?
So one, especially for little tiny like toy breed dogs, it's that somebody was holding them and they jumped out of their arms because they're very squirrely and excited and they just move fast, you know? And so a drop from, if you're a 6 foot person and you drop a, you know, half a kilogram Yorkie, that's a large drop. You know, that'd be like us on, I don't know, four stories or something like that. So I've seen that one with, you know, a handful of times in my career. And then the other thing is recliners. So I have seen multiple puppies and kittens that have been trapped under recliners, and some of them have had head trauma. Some of them have had luxated hips, like all kinds of things from getting stuck under there. And then the other one is hit by cars. So,
Now, hit by car, that's a disaster. And one hopes that a little puppy or kitten doesn't have the opportunity to escape the home and go outside. About the only thing I can think there is, one, keep your puppy on a leash for sure when you're outside. Yeah. Little kittens probably oughtn't be outside to begin with, if you can avoid it for any reason.
Right.
As far as recliners go, I think I can picture how this happens. You sort of pull the little lever or the pull up on the handle and you lean back and your feet kind of go up too, right? And then when you go to sort of stand up, you move your legs down, it kind of clicks underneath. Maybe that's where the animal gets trapped.
Yeah. It's usually when they're closing the recliner and the puppy or kitten was just under there napping.
So with those, the head injuries or from falling, you know, from getting dropped. And of course, you know, that is that would be a nightmare scenario for any pet owner as well as like any parent. You know, you hold a baby and you think, oh man, please don't squirm and like jump out of my arms. But you know, kittens and puppies are squirmy.
Yeah, they are.
So those kinds of injuries, how might you know that something is wrong that warrants going to a clinic right away?
Yeah, so usually fairly rapidly, if they've had head trauma, they're going to have an altered mentation. And so they'll be either like really lethargic, really quiet. They may not be able to stand. They may have what's called ataxia, where it looks like they're kind of walking around drunk. So any of those things would be a pretty good indication. And I've had two that that just became completely comatose and non-responsive. And so, a handful of things.
Okay.
Change of mentation.
Let's go to the phones now. Let's talk to Deborah in the Villages. Deborah, welcome to Animal Airwaves Live. Thanks for calling.
Thank you, Dana. Just a couple of comments. I do have a Siamese domestic short hair. And when she was a kitten, I don't do this now, but I have a bed. And, of course, next to the bed, like a lot of folks, I have a little table there and I have a lamp on it. I've never had an animal do this before, but kitten at about maybe 14 weeks during the middle of the night chomped on the cord, and I woke up to this horrific, horrific scream. Mm-hmm. I wasn't sure right away. I threw myself out of the bed onto the floor, realized what the problem was. Of course, now I recognize in hindsight that maybe it wasn't so smart, but I grabbed her, which now I'm part of the electrical circuit. While I did feel tingling in my arm, I ripped her off the cord, and she raced through the house. Her hair was standing on end. My other cat didn't know what the problem was, and he was trying to meow to get her to calm down. I finally got her in my arms and just had to sit with her for almost 2 hours. I didn't have the presence of mind to check her mouth, but she's a little hardy thing and toughy. She ended up being fine, but it does happen. And the other thing I just recently attempted to, her playmate brother died. He was older than she and Simca. And so I attempted to bring home another female kitty and around the same age, and it ended up being a fiasco. Mm-hmm. Simca had learned to be in the house without her big brother for 6 months. And when I brought home Bella, it just did not work out. And I did everything Dr. Allen suggested and then some. I tried repeatedly going back to scratch, you know, and putting the one in the bedroom so the other one could smell, and feeding each one of them on the other side of the door simultaneously, and being in the bedroom with the newcomer with the door ajar so they could sniff each other. It didn't work out. And unfortunately, and it broke my heart, I had to bring the new kitty, Bella, back to the shelter. And I wept because, you know, animals, that we have enough in this world that are disposable. Animals should not be disposable. And it broke my heart. So just a couple of comments, really, not questions.
Yeah, thank you so much, Deborah. You know, it really sounds like you did your best. And sometimes I think there's just nothing anybody can do. So I had two adult cats that were actually sisters from the same litter. And while they were young, they got along well. But by the time they were, 5 years old, they really didn't enjoy being in each other's presence so much anymore. And we kind of had to keep them apart. One could be inside and the other didn't want to be inside anymore. And so
yeah. It breaks your heart.
Yeah. You want the best for your pets. Sometimes, for whatever reason, they just can't get along. So I really appreciate your call. I'm so glad that your little Siamese kitten ended up being okay. I can think of hardly anything cuter than a little Siamese kitten.
I have been an animal lover, and I've had animals all my life, dogs and cats. I have never, ever, ever had a cat or kitten get electrocuted before. I guess I'm just really fortunate, based on listening to Dr. Allen and the different outcomes. She's a hardy little thing and a puppy, and everything all was well, but it was frightful for me. I can imagine she now does not go anywhere near electrical cords.
Yeah.
she has learned her lesson.
Mm-hmm.
And also too, she's also learned about going outside. I lost her for a week. Somehow she got out on me. And it was Judah that brought her back sometime before. He meowed and meowed every night until he finally got her to come back home. I opened the door and there she was. So she's also learned never to go near the door. I mean, sometimes they have to learn the hard way. So anyway, just comments.
Thank you so much, Deborah. Thanks for listening. Thanks for calling in.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Dr. Allen, let us go next to another one on your list. That would be... let's go to, say, foreign bodies.
Mm, mm-hmm.
What's happening in this instance?
Again, puppies and kittens, they like to eat things, right? So if we're stereotyping the two species, I think puppies more often eat their toys, toys and cloth-type materials. Kittens really love hairbands and rubber bands and things of that nature. They love to play with them and bat them around, and they also love to eat them. So when they eat them, I mean, their intestinal tract is very small and the diameter of it is very small. And so if they don't vomit them back up from their stomach, which sometimes they'll do because it'll sit there in their pylorus for a while and cause them to feel kind of bad, and they'll just puke up the foreign body, which is great. But if they don't, and you don't know that they ate it, right, because that's the hard part, is you don't, maybe you didn't realize that something went missing, then it can cause an obstruction in their intestinal tract, in which case sometimes they'll pass things and then sometimes they won't, and we have to go in surgically and remove them.
With these kinds of things, I mean, everybody would want to give a little puppy or a kitten a toy to play with.
Yeah.
You might not throw a kitten a hair tie. I would understand not doing that. Though I certainly have had cats that thought hair ties were the greatest.
Uh-huh.
And you just like carry them around in the mouth and everything.
Yeah.
But one of the things that you might do with your puppy is give it a toy so it doesn't chew on things it shouldn't be chewing on.
Exactly.
So you can run into trouble there if it begins to tear up the toy or, chew on some other foreign body.
Yeah.
How might you know that something has gone wrong?
So usually they'll stop eating first. So stop eating and start vomiting. And a lot of things can cause that, not just foreign bodies, but that would be a typical sign. And there's also, if you just walk through the aisles at PetSmart these days, their companies are getting a lot better about recognizing this issue. So there's a lot of non-destructible toys out there, at least not 100% non-destructible, but there's a lot now that you can do for your pets that they can't chew up and ingest as readily as they can with some other things.
On this program before, a conversation has occurred about things that you might give to dogs to chew on.
Mm-hmm.
And a common object that a dog might be given to chew on would be like rawhide. Is that safe for puppies?
I'm not a proponent of the rawhide. there's probably a lot of opinions on rawhide out there, so I'm not going to give my opinion on it, but I have seen where they try and swallow it whole, and then it gets stuck in their esophagus. And so you have an esophageal foreign body now. The other thing is people like to give puppies and kittens like beef jerky, and that's kind of very similar to rawhide texture. So I've had to take one of them, this little Chihuahua puppy, the cutest little puppy ever. She was 14 weeks old, and she actually got the piece of beef jerky stuck up the back of her nose. So we had to pull it off in the back of her nose. But anyway, so I think those things have a potential for not them just swallowing them whole and getting stuck in the lumen of a tube, which is usually their esophagus.
Ugh. Okay. So best to just keep that stuff away.
I would say so. Yeah. I mean, Kongs are a better option. So
what is
that? Like the Kong toys that that are fairly non-destructible that they can chew on, and you can put like smear a little bit of something tasty on the inside of it.
Oh, yeah. I don't know if I know those.
Oh yeah.
Huh.
Yeah.
Let's go to hypoglycemia. You mentioned you when talking about the burn in the mouth, mm-hmm. right, and not eating. Mm-hmm. You sort of alluded to how an animal that doesn't eat, particularly like a toy breed, might get hypoglycemic.
Mm-hmm.
Hypoglycemia in general, is that something that occurs for multiple reasons?
So it's usually a toy breed issue. So are Yorkies and Malteses and kind of those types of small breeds. And puppies in general have like a few reasons why they're more susceptible to hypoglycemia. So we store glucose in our liver as glycogen. And when they're babies, they don't have a fully functioning liver yet. And so they don't have the glycogen stores that we do as adults. We make glucose every day. And so that's called gluconeogenesis. That also isn't up to par. Their kidneys are still developing. So they actually pee out glucose every day. Whereas you and I, like, we shouldn't be peeing out any glucose unless we have diabetes. So, and then there's also these hormones in your body that help you. If your blood sugar is going to drop, then you're going to have a release of certain hormones that's going to help you bring that glucose back up to normal. And puppies and kittens don't have those, like, they're just not fully functioning systems yet. So they're, all puppies and kittens have the potential to have hypoglycemia. I think that it's definitely more of an issue with the toy breeds. And so to kind of prevent – so what I recommend for toy breeds is to just feed them frequently. So small, frequent meals so that way they always have a food substance in their body to try and help offset the issue.
If we can talk a little bit about food for just a moment, and I imagine this would be the right time. It's not necessarily an emergency at all, but – what do you recommend in terms of feeding, let's say, a new puppy or something? Because these are really tiny animals, you know. They can't eat the same things that, like, an adult animal would eat, a commercially available sort of puppy or kitten food.
Yeah. I mean, that's what – I mean, I fed my puppies when they were puppies, commercially available puppy or kitten food. The little ones, like the toy breeds, again, I think feeding them more frequently throughout the day is beneficial. But I think most puppies can eat, you know, 2 to 3 times a day and be just fine. Hmm. So, but I wouldn't feed them, you know, like they need certain micronutrients and vitamins and stuff that's going to be in a balanced pet food. So I wouldn't do like a home cooked diet unless you know what you're doing.
So if something were wrong, mm-hmm. with the hypoglycemia, what would you notice if this were happening to your pet?
Oh, that's a good question. So usually it's weakness. So they're going to be weak and lethargic and just not interacting with you. If it gets really bad, which sometimes happens, they start having seizures. Their brain is very, very, very dependent on a normal blood glucose. And so you get what's called neuroglycopenia, where it starts causing seizures, basically.
Oof. Mm-hmm. Okay. It's 40 minutes now after 1 o'clock. You're listening to Animal Airwaves Live on WUFT-FM. I'm Dana Hill. My guest is Dr. Ashley Allen. We're going to take a short break, and we're going to be back with more of the show right after this. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Animal Airwaves Live. Thanks for listening today. I'm Dana Hill, and my guest today is Dr. Ashley Allen from the UF College of Veterinary Medicine. And we're talking about puppies and kittens and how one can avoid common veterinary emergencies. I appreciate you listening. I also appreciate those of you who have pledged your support to WUFT during this membership campaign. If you haven't had your chance yet, and if you love Animal Airwaves Live and want to support the program, go to our website, wuft.org. and make your contribution there. Meanwhile, if you'd like to join our conversation on the radio, 392 8989 is the number. We mentioned just a little while ago, Dr. Allen, foreign bodies. And it occurs to me that folks who have more questions about this, next week, my guest is going to be one of your colleagues, Dr. Gary Ellison. And the topic is going to be, your dog ate what? How to keep your pets, toys, and more from being trouble. So listeners, stay tuned for that next week. That's March 30th at 1 o'clock. Meanwhile, getting back to our list of potential emergencies with puppies and kittens, parasitic anemia. I think I know what we're talking about here, but maybe you can explain.
Yeah. So there are some parasites that either affect the gastrointestinal tract or they're ectoparasites, meaning they're on the skin, that like to take their blood. So the ones that affect their gastrointestinal tract that are probably the biggest cause of the anemia part are hookworms. And then the ones ectoparasite-wise are fleas. So both of those, they can suck a lot of blood out of a puppy or kitten, especially if it goes on for a long period of time. And then ticks as well, they suck a lot of blood as well. So essentially, the parasitic anemia is an intestinal burden of worms or superficially a bunch of fleas that goes untreated. And so, I mean, we have to to the point that they need a blood transfusion.
Wow.
So probably, again, somewhere in the range of, 10 to 20 cases per year, we have to give puppies and kittens blood just to offset the anemia and treat the parasite. So,
Some listeners might be surprised to know that puppies and kittens can get blood transfusions to begin with, which is kind of an amazing aspect of modern veterinary medicine, that there are blood transfusions available for animals. But first, I would ask, what can one do to minimize the exposure of animals to some of these parasites in the environment?
Yeah, so this is one of the things that I think is fairly preventable. So one is routine deworming. So all female dogs at birth, not all of them, but because I can't make that claim, but a lot of them, the parasite ova insists in their mammary tissue. And so when those puppies and kittens nurse, they're going to ingest those parasite ova, which are the eggs. And then so essentially we think all puppies probably are going to have an intestinal burden of worms by the time they're about 3 to 4 weeks of age. That's why we start deworming them at around that time, because a dewormer doesn't kill eggs. A dewormer kills adults. And so routine deworming with your veterinarian is 100% recommended to try and prevent the intestinal anemia. Superficially, the fleas, I mean, it's springtime is a classic time when fleas are out and about. And so there are things like, if you see fleas in your house, you probably have a huge flea burden. So making sure your house is treated, making sure your yard is treated, making sure that you, community areas and apartment complexes, that if there's a flea problem there, walk the puppy somewhere else. And then cats are, there's one particular thing about cats that's a little bit unique just for all the cat lovers out there. The fleas actually can carry something called Mycoplasma haemophilus, which is basically like a little infectious disease that attacks their red cells. So they basically, they get this parasite. It literally lives on the surface of the red cell. And then the body is like, hey, that's not normal. I'm going to go in and get rid of all those cells. So they get what's called a hemolytic anemia, where they're going in and attacking those cells and getting them out of circulation because there's a parasite there. So that's one of the more common reasons to have to transfuse kittens for this.
What form does a dewormer take? Is it a pill?
No, most of them are liquids. There are some pills. So it just depends on whatever the veterinary practice keeps in on their shelf. But Pyrantel is a common one that treats both hookworms and roundworms.
How does it work?
So it actually messes with the the sodium and chloride channels on the surface of the intestinal parasite. So it kind of like almost paralyzes them so that then it kills them and they kind of put a lot of fluid into the inside of their body and then they poop out the dead worms.
Huh.
Yeah.
Well, that sounds horrifying, but if it's effective, then that's really wonderful. Nobody wants to think about an animal, it's particularly a tiny little animal, being covered in fleas, especially when it can be so discomforting and so forth. But the you know, the small nature of puppies and kittens means that, you know, having a lot of fleas could potentially be more dangerous, right, than if they were full size. I don't know. Maybe there's more surface area on a full size one, so it could just have more fleas.
Yeah.
I don't know how it balances out. Suffice it to say, you don't want your puppy or kitten to have fleas, but at what age is it safe to use anti-flea medication on them?
Most of the products are going to be somewhere between 8 and 16 weeks of age. So I would, again, talk to whoever you should be establishing a relationship with a veterinarian when you have a puppy or kitten. That way they can kind of go through these things with you, get them vaccinated so we don't deal with things like parvo, although it's still a possibility even with a vaccine. And so it's kind of whatever they have at their clinic. But most of the products are somewhere between 8 and 16 weeks of age. The ones that are younger than that, there's not really any like 100% safe product. There are some things that we can do topically to try and minimize it. And then we treat the environment like crazy.
So, yeah. Mm-hmm. You mentioned parvo just now.
Mm-hmm.
How common is that with little puppies and kittens?
Yeah, it's pretty common. From a caseload perspective, and again, at the vet school, we usually only see the sickest of the sickest parvo cases. I don't know, if I had to make up a number, probably somewhere between 30 and 50 dogs between our two clinics a year are going to be hospitalized in isolation with parvovirus. And I'm sure that the majority of dogs with parvo get treated at their primary care veterinarian and don't need to be, you know, sent over to the vet school. So it's a very contagious virus. It's spread from the feces. So it's any contact with feces that, you know, from a dog that's shedding parvo. And puppies are really susceptible to it because puppies are kind of born with no natural immunity to it. They get the immunity to it from nursing from the mom. Especially if you have a puppy that maybe didn't get as much colostrum as the other ones or didn't get any colostrum at all, if it's like an orphan puppy that was hand raised or the mom died or something like that, that puppy is going to be super susceptible. And then the vaccines are created and administered in a way. So at some point, if they got colostrum, the maternal antibodies are going to be decreasing over time, and the puppy's immune system is going to start making antibodies with the vaccines that we give. So there's always that cross between those two that we can't predict because every puppy's different and the amount of antibodies they got is different, that they're going to be susceptible. So it's really avoiding the potential. So dog parks I would stay away from with new puppies. I know everybody wants to go out and play with them and stuff like that, but I mean, you take a risk doing those things. Pet stores, like if you don't have to bring the puppy to the pet store with you, then I just wouldn't, because I mean, they're just like kids in daycare, right? They pick up all kinds of things.
Yeah, for sure. Not as big a deal with cats?
No, cats can get parvo, but it's not as a big a deal as it is. It's not the same parvo. So like dogs don't spread parvo to cats and back and forth.
If an animal gets infected with it, what courses of treatment are available?
It's really just supportive care. And so parvo is a virus. So there's not any one treatment in the world that's going to kill a virus, right? But what parvo does is it lives in what's called the intestinal crypts, which is kind of like the entire lining of your gastrointestinal tract. And so the virus invades there, and then all those cells slough off. And so then you have a dog that's having bloody diarrhea, a lot of diarrhea, vomiting, can't keep food down, and you're a 16-week-old puppy. And we just talked about all the hypoglycemia issues. So they're just open for infection because their white cells go down quite a bit. Now you have a dog that, you know, what normally lives in the poop is a bunch of bacteria, right? And now you don't have that normal intestinal lining to prevent that bacteria from getting in their bloodstream. So they're pretty at risk for sepsis and hypoglycemia.
You said it's where in the intestine?
In the intestinal crypts. So it's,
how do you spell that?
Like a crypt, C-R-Y.
Wow, that's like two terrible words together for one really terrible thing. Okay. What is another potential danger? Toxicities?
Oh, yeah. Toxicities, again, because puppies like to eat things. So jotted down a list of a few that I just see more frequently. So chocolate, Right? Puppies love chocolate. I love chocolate.
Sure.
Yeah, it tastes great. So the dark chocolate's the one that's going to cause most of the signs instead of the milk chocolate. But if they eat enough milk chocolate, they can have signs of toxicity. Usually, if they got enough to actually be clinically affected, it goes in a continuum. So usually they're going to puke and have diarrhea first. And if they ate enough to then cause more signs, they may have some cardiac arrhythmias that we have to contend with. And then if they ate enough to cause even more signs, they may start having seizures.
There's probably no way to know specifically how much is enough to cause a problem with any individual animal.
Chocolate is one of those things, if you know exactly how much was ingested, we have like little things called chocolate toxicity calculators. So, and you can input that in the calculator if it's milk chocolate or dark chocolate and things like that. And so there's like a mg per kg amount of chocolate that we expect clinical signs with. So that's the only one on my list.
Yeah. Well, that's an amazing thing that they've make little calculators for that.
Yeah.
There's specialty items for everything.
Right.
So one doesn't want an animal like a puppy or a kitten to get into anything that it shouldn't be getting into. That mm-hmm. sounds like it's, you know, animals getting into things is one of the real big problems that it seems like is a recurring theme here.
Yeah.
You know, be it, you know, foreign bodies or be it electrocution, right? This is just because animals are getting into stuff that they shouldn't, in which case, you know, about the best you can do is supervise, you know, your young animals until such time, I guess, that you kind of understand their personality or they grow out of it or what. I don't know about how long it takes before a puppy or a kitten begins to calm down and not be so mischievous.
Mm-hmm. They're all different. I mean, so I just lost my Cocker Spaniel January of last year, and he was 15. That dog would – I had to treat him. He ate a whole – pillowcase full of Halloween candy when he was 12. So, I mean, it can happen at any point in their lives. So really just knowing your own dog and trying to minimize the chance that can happen. I'm going to throw one other thing on the toxicity list just that I want listeners to be aware of because this is Florida sago palm. So
sure.
I don't know if you've talked about that in the past, but every part of that plant is toxic.
It's come up, and I think that many people don't even realize how omnipresent it is around here.
Yeah.
I could walk 15 feet out of this building mm-hmm. and there'd be sago palm, which, yep. you know, I don't go walking the dog around here, but you have it in your neighborhood. You have it near the parks where you go. You have it yep. around. And I don't know necessarily that, you know, a dog would be super inclined to just run up and start eating it, but mm-hmm. animals do weird things.
Right. Yeah, and I don't know what makes them eat that plant. You know, I don't know if it tastes good or something because, I mean, think of all the other plants that they bypass, and we see enough sago palm toxicity that it's a thing, and it's so if you look at all the papers published on it, it has about a 50% mortality rate at least.
Yeah.
And so I would just get rid of them. If you have them in your yard and you have dogs, just call a landscaper, get rid of them, and make sure they don't mulch it.
Really good advice. Dr. Ashley Allen, thanks for being here.
Oh, thanks.
I want to say thank you to Richard Drake and Glenn Richards in the studio. Thanks to Sarah Carey. I appreciate you listeners and donors. Thank you, and join me again next week for another Animal Airwaves Live.